This morning, I'd like to offer some thoughts about engaging in Judaism, and specifically in what we might think of as sort of normative Judaism, as a mindfulness practice. I feel very lucky that the course of my life's journey first led me, in terms of my spiritual practice, first led me into Buddhism when I was a freshman in college. Before coming to the tradition of my birth, to Judaism, because after having studied in Buddhism in a very serious way, I mean, not too serious, but in an intensive way, when I came into Jewish life, I was already operating under the assumption that Jewish life, Jewish practice, was pointing towards spiritual practice, that it was a mindfulness practice. So I feel very lucky to have had that kind of course of events unfold in that way, because when I was in my 20s and I became interested in Judaism, I couldn't help but see a mindfulness practice. You know, really, mindfulness practices everywhere. in our tradition. And so I certainly learned the Shema when I was a little kid, but when I came back into it in my 20s, I didn't know how anybody else didn't see it as a mindfulness practice. So I want to offer some thoughts really to look at some sources that come from, I'd say from the foundation of our tradition today, that I think leaving Buddhism aside, really point towards Jewish living as a mindfulness practice. That Jewish living and Jewish spiritual practice is about working with consciousness, is about cultivating awareness, as Jeff said. And I don't know exactly what those terms mean. I have a working understanding. I love, Jeff, that you pointed towards the fuzziness of those definitions. We'll touch upon those a bit. But I'd like to begin with just recounting very briefly a story in the Torah that speaks to the human experience, I think, in such a beautiful and poignant way. And then a brief story from my own life that kind of highlights a certain element of it. So the story is from chapter 13 of Bamidbar, of the book of Numbers, and Parashat Shlach Lecha, the story of the scouts, the first time we read about the scouts. And if you're not familiar with the story, go check it out. For those of you who are familiar with the story, in brief, Moses and the Israelites are on the kind of the edge of the land of Israel. They haven't wandered for 40 years yet, and they're trying to figure out, you know, kind of how to get in. And Moses sends a group of scouts, not called spies here, a group of scouts into the land, and they're actually chieftains of the different tribes. And they go into the land, and Moses says, go into the land, vilatur et haaretz. Latur is a verb that in modern Hebrew is related to the word for to be a tourist, right? So it's Moses says, go check it out, go investigate the land. Is it fertile or is it, you know, dry? Are the cities fortified or are they open? What's it like? Go check it out. There's not the sense of deviousness that we often think about as to go spy out the land. But at first, Moses just says, go check out the land. This is our experience, right? We come into this new moment, in a sense, a new land. And there's the possibility that we might go in and investigate and see what is the quality of this moment, right, of this breath, of this body. What is this? So the scouts go in, and they check it out, and indeed it is fertile, and they need sticks to carry a cluster of grapes back, because it's just the land is so rich. And they bring back this, you know, cluster of grapes, which is now the icon of the Israel Ministry of Tourism, right? Two people schlepping this big cluster of grapes. They come back and give their report, and they say, I'll read it to you briefly. At the end of 40 days, they returned from scouting the land. They went straight to Moses and Aaron and the whole Israelite community at Kadesh in the wilderness of Paran, and they made their report to them and to the whole community as they showed them the fruit of the land. This is what they told him. We came to the land you sent us to. It does indeed flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. However, the people who inhabit the country are powerful, and the cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the Anakites there. Right? It means giants. Amalekites dwell in the Negev region, right? A hostile tribe. Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites, oh my. inhabit the hill country, and Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the Jordan." Caleb hushed the people before Moses and said, "Let us by all means go up, and we shall gain possession of it, for we shall surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We cannot attack that people, for it is stronger than we." Thus they spread calumnies, right, bad reports among the Israelites about the land they had scouted, saying, "The country that we traversed and scouted is one that devours its settlers. All the people that we saw in it are men of great size. We saw the Nephilim there." The Anakites are part of the Nephilim, right? These giant people. "And we looked like grasshoppers to ourselves. We looked like grasshoppers to ourselves. And so we must have looked to them." Oh. That end, every time I read it, it gets me because I can resonate with it so deeply. Right? How many times do I go into a new experience and I come into it with the sense of, I'm a grasshopper? Where I'm sitting here in meditation, struggling to stay awake, and I feel like, who am I to do this? Surely, you know, the people that I might work with or that I hope to teach someday, if I see myself as a grasshopper, surely they will see me even more so as a grasshopper. So, the Torah describes this very human experience of coming into a new place, a new experience, and being overcome for good reason, actually, with a sense of fear. It's not that there's no reason to be afraid. It's not that there aren't any giants in the land. It tells us there are giants there. But what do we do in response to this reality of the human experience? Two chapters later, in the same Torah portion, comes a practice that I think comes in response to it. And our sages link these two episodes with a kind of one similarity is that is a linkage between the verb latur, to investigate, which becomes this investigation, which was intended, it seems, to be very like neutral. Right? Go and investigate your experience, is what Moses says. And it becomes controlled by fear. This happens all the time. Something comes and it influences, it controls, it takes over a possibility of being in our experience in a way that we're just flush with the ever-unfolding experience, investigating it. That verb latur is related to velo taturu, the same root, which we'll see here in this paragraph, which describes the tzitzit, the fringes on the corners of the talit. And what I'd like to propose is that this is one example of many in which we see arising from our tradition really a mindfulness practice. And I want to flesh it out a little bit together. You know, I'll read it and then I'll tell the story that I was going to tell you. Hashem said to Moses as follows. I'm looking at the sheet now. "Speak to the Israelite people and instruct them to make for themselves fringes on the corners of their garments throughout the ages. Let them attach a petil techelet, a cord of blue, to the fringe at each corner. That shall be your fringe. V'haya lechem letzitzit, uritem oto, uschartem et kol mitzvot Hashem v'asitem otam, v'lo taturu," right, there's our verb, "achrei levavchem v'achrei eneichem, asher atem zonim achreihem." That shall be your fringe. Look at it and remember all the mitzvot, the commandments of the boundless one, and do them, so that you do not follow your heart and eyes and your lustful urge. Laman tiskeru v'yasitim et kol mitzvotai v'item kiroshim leilo kechem. Ni Hashem elokechem asher hoteiti etchem eretz mitzrayim liot lachem leilukim. Ni Hashem elokechem. Thus you shall be reminded to observe all my commandments and be holy. Right. Etc. I see this as a practice that comes in response to this very human experience. Right? You're going to forget. Chieftains, you're going to forget. Things are going to arise that are going to control how you relate to the experience. And it is a new experience. But it's okay. Because you can remember. Last winter, my sister-in-law got married in Toronto. And our son, Adin, who is 6 years old, was asked, to his incredible delight, to be the ring bearer. And my sister-in-law, Mary, asked him this months and months in advance, and he had been looking forward to it. He was so excited. And when the big day came, I was actually officiating the wedding, and so I had this amazing view of Adin walking down the aisle towards the chuppah. And I could see him walking, and he walked so beautifully and regally. I was so proud of him. He really inhabited this role as the ring bearer with great poise and pride. I was quelling, as you can imagine. And so he came up with the ring, and he did his job, and then he sat down. The chuppah, you know, progressed, etc. We're fast forward to the reception, and it was the first kind of simcha dance, you know, when we're all like dancing the hora, and tons of energy and lots of people, and everybody's dancing, and I was right by Adin because I was afraid he was going to get trampled, and we're dancing, and he's having so much fun, and then they bring out the chairs, and they put the bride and the groom on the chairs. And Adin looks at me and he says, "Abba, I want to go next." And I said, "Adin, that's only for, you know, the couple that's getting married and their parents." And he did this. Humph. Actually said humph. Which I loved. And he said, "Humph, I want to go there." And I could tell that he went from this great joy, which I saw is flowing from the moment he walked down the aisle as the ring bearer, into this state of despair, right? And as a six-year-old, this is, you know, goes with the territory. Not just six-year-olds, I should say, as we all know. And somehow the thought came into my head to lean. I leaned into him, and I said, "Adin, do not forget, you are the ring bearer." And he thought for a second, and then he smiled, and then he started dancing again. Yeah, it could have gone anyway. So, might have had no effect. Might have had no effect, for sure. But in that moment, I reminded him of something. I reminded him of who he was. Right now, one of the things that I, when I think about the story that makes me smile is that there's also this sort of, and Sheila and I've told the story before, we were debriefing, and she said, "Oh, that's just like The Lord of the Rings." And it's so true, because, you know, I love that sense, and I think that was kind of resonating in the moment, the sense of, you have a mission. You have a purpose. There's something important that you are here to do, ring bearer. Right? You are carrying the ring. And indeed, we all carry a ring. We all have this kind of sense of a holy purpose in this world. And yet it is so easy to forget that, especially when we have other reasons, you know, when we have reasons to think otherwise. Right? There are giants there. Or I'm not good enough. Or I don't know Hebrew. Or I'm just starting this job. Or et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It's not that we don't have reasons, even valid ones, to perhaps doubt who we are. But our tradition says that we can remember. And even more, we can remember to remember. And even more, we can remind ourselves to remember to remember. Remember. What do I mean by that? I see the tzitzit as an example. Again, it's not the only one, but as an example, a profound example of how we can use, we can really harness the faculty of memory in order to reframe our consciousness. The Talmud picks up on this idea. And you'll see the next source from Menachot. Beautiful, the whole passage, the whole sugya is really quite beautiful. It speaks about tzitzit and the talit and in all different ways. And the Talmud picks up on this passage from Numbers, this passage of the tzitzit, and it says, it picks up on three verbs. Uritem oto ischartem ve'asitem. Look at it and remember and then do or observe as it's translated here. And then it creates a formula. Ri'iya mivya lide zechira. Zechira mivya lide asiya. Looking upon leads to remembrance. Remembrance leads to doing or to action. And so here I wrote on the page there these three boxes. Ri'iya, zechira, asiya. The Talmud puts them in a kind of sequence. In my experience, it doesn't always happen like that. Sometimes zichira then informs ri'ya, or asiya then leads to zichira, etc. But I think it's quite a beautiful formula that we have these three different boxes. One is ri'ya, perception, and Jeff sort of started opening that up last night. How do we perceive what's around us? How do we bear witness to what arises moment by moment? That's part of our experience and part of our practice, to really bring intention into how we do ri'ya. The second box, zechira, which I'm going to unpack much more in a moment. Zechira means remember, primarily, but can also really mean to be mindful. And again, we'll talk about that in a moment. I'll come back to that. The third one, asiya, doing. So one of the things I love about this formula is it says that consciousness or even awareness isn't the culmination, but it's actually how does that awareness or consciousness then come to inform action. So again, that's another piece we'll unpack a bit in a moment. But now back to zechira. So if you just look at the bottom of the page, this little quote from the late and brilliant biblicist Nachum Sarna, and this is in his commentary to the book of Exodus, one of the JPS commentaries, on the verse from the beginning of the story of the Exodus, really, in which it says that the Israelites cry out to God from their oppression, and God hears it and remembers. And Sarna goes on to talk about sometimes God remembers, sometimes the Israelites remember. We see both in the Torah. But then he says this. The Hebrew stem zachar connotes much more than the recall of things past. It means, rather, to be mindful, to pay heed, signifying a sharp focusing of attention upon someone or something. It embraces concern and involvement and is active, not passive. so that it eventuates in action. So Sarna is saying this notion of zikhira, we need to be careful about how we understand it, because there are different ways that we can remember. Let me give you an example. In my office, kind of behind my desk, I have a framed photograph of my sister and her son, my nephew. He's now 13, and in the picture, he's probably 4. And they're holding hands and stepping into the ocean, kind of stepping like just where the ocean meets the sand. And I love this photograph for a number of reasons, which I don't even need to go into. But I find it incredibly meaningful. Well, I'll say one thing about it. Right? To me, it speaks to the human experience of wading out into this sea of being, but we don't need to do it alone, right? That we can hold each other's hands and love each other as we go into it. And there are other associations I have with this photograph, but that's enough for now. So I have it there on my wall. Now, 3 things could happen when I see it with my eyes. One possibility is that nothing happens. Right, I see it, but nothing, you know, I don't think about it. Nothing really nothing happens. It's just in the background. The second possibility is that I see it and I have a kind of passive recollection, as Sarna points towards. Oh, yeah, that was a great vacation. That's a beautiful picture. And then I move on. I mean, nothing really shifts in terms of my consciousness. The third possibility, and the one that I think is what we're talking about here with zikhira, is that I see the picture and it reminds me in an active way. Oh yeah. I can do this. Right? Or I can be in this sea and I'm not alone. Whatever it might be, the content is not what's important here. But the fact that it, in an active way, comes and it reframes my consciousness. And here is sort of the, in some ways, like for me, the metric for if it was really a zikhira. When I do that, what happens next is different. The asiya that follows is different. And so I might see it, and then the phone rings, and I know that the way I answer that phone and respond to the, you know, the insurance agent or whoever is different than if I hadn't had that zikhira. So, zikhira, I think we can think about as an intentional harnessing of the faculty of memory, so that we change consciousness, so that we can act differently. Many things can act as zikhirot. Tzitzit, other physical objects, and if we have time, I want to talk about mezuzot also, the mezuzah on the door frame. But also other people. This is something Sheila also reminded me of perfectly. She was a zikhira to me when we were talking about this, that we can remind each other. Right? In the story with my son, I served as a zikhira to him. Right? So one of the things we can do as a chavruta, as a with our partners, with our friends, right, or even... Isn't it amazing when you're in the store and somebody smiles to you for no reason, how it can change everything for you? Right, so we can act as zikhirot for each other. Our tradition is filled with zikhirot. in an incredibly beautiful and rich way. Including, you know, Monday we had Yom HaShoah. Right? And we say around, you know, things like that, or when we remember people who passed away, right? Zichrono livracha, right? His or her memory should be a blessing. So the idea isn't just, oh yeah, I remember that person, or I remember that tragedy kind of passively, but how can I bring it into my consciousness so that it changes who I am? I see this all the time with funerals, I have to say. And as a rabbi, it's something I feel incredibly privileged to be part of, because you see that in the midst of tragedy and loss, we can remember what is truly important. And so we leave the funeral, and of course, we wish that we didn't have to go to that funeral. We wish that person was still with us. But what's the difference between feeling that and then pushing it aside and feeling it and then coming home and listening with a different quality of being and walking with a different quality of being? So please turn the page over. Another thing my dear teacher, Sheila, told me when I first told her about this idea, like I stumbled across this passage in the Gemara, and I was telling her about it, and she said, oh yeah, zichira, remembrance, that's just like sati in the Pali. Right? So you'll see in a moment. This quote comes from a really excellent website from the Mind and Life Institute, which is an organization that's dedicated to understanding the mind and how it works with meditation and kind of that field more broadly. And there are many interesting articles on there. This is something I found there. Sustained voluntary attention, samadhi, is closely related to memory, because in order to deliberately sustain one's attention upon its chosen object, right, concentration, one must continue to remember to do so from moment to moment, faithfully returning back to refocus on that object whenever the mind wanders away from it. So we actually practice zikhira all the time in our meditation practice. When we remember to return, when we remember to do teshuva, to return to our object of awareness, when we remember to return to breath, body, etc., we are harnessing memory towards this end. Right? This is zikhira. Likewise, in Buddhism, the faculty of mindfulness, smriti, refers not only to moment-to-moment awareness of present events. Instead, the primary connotation of this Sanskrit term and its corresponding Pali term, sati, is recollection. This includes long-term, short-term, and working memory, non-forgetful, present-centered awareness, and also prospective memory, i.e. remembering to be aware of something or to do something at a designated time in the future. In these ways, from a contemplative perspective, memory is critically linked to attention, and both of these mental faculties have important ramifications for the experiential and phenomenological study of the mind, its training, and potential optimization. Right? So, if you want to increase mindfulness, work with memory, really intentionally. The term that when 19th century British scholars of Buddhism translated this term that they were seeing over and over again in the ancient Buddhist texts, in Sanskrit as smriti or in Pali as sati, they were translating that word as mindfulness. It has the root of memory, remember, recollection. And so one way we can relate to mindfulness, I think really kind of organically, in Jewish tradition, is this idea of zechira. Right? We say Friday night Kiddush, zecher letziat Mitzrayim. What does it mean for Shabbat to remind us of the Exodus from Egypt? That's about consciousness. On Shabbat afternoon, I'm going to talk more about Shabbat as a mindfulness practice, and we'll touch upon that a bit more. But look for it. It's all over the place. So, one more example. Again, not an esoteric source. I intentionally wanted to draw at this point from these kind of bread and butter sources. I don't know what the Jewish equivalent of that is, like, you know, herring. Herring and gefilte fish sources, I don't know. This is from the Rambam, Maimonides, from his great legal compendium of Jewish law, the Mishneh Torah. And this comes at the end of a discussion of the laws concerning tefillin and mezuzah, and also part of it also touches upon writing Torah scrolls. So a person must show great care in the observance of the mitzvah of mezuzah, because it is an obligation which is constantly incumbent upon everyone. V'chol zman sheyikanes v'yetze yifga b'yichud Hashem shemo shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu v'yizkor ahavato. Through its observance, whenever one enters or leaves a house, one will encounter, literally, one will strike, like bump into. Right? Like Yaakov, vayifga b'makom. Yaakov encounters the divine, as the sages understand that term. I could tell you more about that if you're curious what I'm referring to some other time. The sense of, here's the mezuzah on my door, I'm in the middle of a million things, I walk by it, I see it, and there's the opportunity for zichira. It reminds me of the unification, the unity of the name of the Holy One, blessed be. And then vayiskor, I remember divine love. What might it be like if when we walked by a mezuzah, we paused, we breathed in and out, and we remembered that I am loved? Not theoretically, but really brought that in, felt that love. That is a profound mindfulness practice. V'ya'or mishnato u'shkiyotav v'hevle azman v'yeda she'en devar ha'omeh le'olam ul'olmei olamim ela yedi'at tzur ha'olam. Thus one will awaken from sleep and one's obsession with the vanities of time, and know that there is nothing which lasts for eternity except the knowledge of the rock of the world. Oh my goodness, there's so much in this. Right? You have that moment of mindfulness, of zichira. You feel loved, and then you awaken from your sleep. And you're... the way in which we are obsessing about whatever we're obsessing about, right? Or we're worried about whatever we're worried about. Not to say that those things aren't real or worthy of our attention, but how often do you walk around your house or your office or your school, wherever you are, and you are just preoccupied with all kinds of things that you know in the big picture are small? And so you remember, I've been spending my whole day, my whole afternoon in mochin de katnut, in small mind, as Jeff and Sheila and Joanna too have been pointing towards. And I remember to awaken from that into big mind. And then we come to a place of da'at, awareness. Da'at comes from the root. Lada'at, that verb, means to know, but intimately, right? It means to know in a biblical sense, right? It also means, has a sexual connotation. Adam knew Eve. So we know, not analytically or conceptually, but in our kishkis, tzur ha'olam. Right, the foundation of the world. So we come from a place in which we're worried about all the little stuff, into an awareness which is really, I think, steady and grounded, present. Umiyad hu chozer leda'ato. And then one will immediately return to awareness. Veholech, and walk in the paths of the upright, said the first sages. So the moment of awareness isn't the end point, but then it informs how we then walk. So when we have that mindful awareness, we then go into the next room and we're perhaps more loving, more present, more steady, more grounded, more awake. I really want to encourage you over the course of this, our time together, not only on retreat, but then as we go home, to enter into Jewish life as a mindfulness practice. This is one small way of doing that, and there are many others. I'd love to learn from you ways in which you find these kinds of practices sort of embedded in our tradition. We can use these reminders, whether it's a mezuzah or a tzitzit or a photograph on our wall, or maybe we collect a stick or a stone from here and we put it on our desk, and that serves as a zikhira, a reminder. But we can use reminders so that we can remember to remember. We can remember to wake up over and over again. So we'll sit for a couple minutes. Thank you for your kind attention.